talk, more focused on radiative corrections, and then I got sent the program and was assigned a title. So I've slightly shifted now in the preparation, and it's of course understandable because there's a huge interest in the topic lately. So my own expertise is more like in hadronic matrix elements in flavor physics and in observables, sort of with angular distributions, which I've lately begun to investigate. So let's see. Now that's the pointer, and this is, so how do you go forward? This way. Good. Okay. Yeah, the overview. I'll have a gentle introduction. We'll define the terms. Oh yeah, flavor universality, which you probably have seen all over the place. Bit of effective Hamiltonian, angular distribution. So this is really the basics, and I should spend about 15 minutes on this. Let's see. And then there is the core of it, the tensions. We have some gosh, okay. We have some tree level.
That's your time estimate for you.
Going forth and back. Yeah, well, didn't calculate this one in. So we have some tree level tensions. We have some tensions which have to do with, which one is now this, with flavor universality in B to SLL and B to D star L nu. I'll do a bit of theory, experimental results, summary of global fits, and in the end, I think this is the most critical part, the reappraisal of charm, which is crucial. Good. Okay, and then we'll end with some remarks on beyond the standard model and motivated searches and conclusions. Very good. All right, introduction. Yeah, there are a few sigmas in town, and so where are they, basically? They are not somehow in the CKM mechanism, if you wish, because as I understood yesterday, that's what you want to do with the lepton matrix. You want to test it, so that's it over the years. It's very impressive. It's difficult to see signs of new physics here, although we'll have a closer look in a few minutes. Good. So where are they? They are sort of maybe in places where we would expect them. In particular, this is a lot of these channels are not tested. Lots of these operators. So they are in B2S LL, to be more precise, in angular observables. There is now also the time-dependent CPS symmetry, although it's not large yet. They are in this ratio here. They just differ by a spectator, these two channels, and in this lepton flavor universality quantity, well, latent quantity here. And they are also at tree level, which is maybe also a bit surprising. VUB exclusive versus the inclusive. And they're also, again, here in the lepton flavor violation channel here, B to D tau versus B to D E or electron or muon. Good. No, that's the wrong way. And yeah, it's fair to say that these three here are rather unexpected here. Good. Right. So what's sort of the generic flavor structure? If we just take order one Wilson coefficients and we write down dimension six operators, then in the flavor sector, the most severe constraints come from mixing. Here. Oh, not this, I'm, this is not gonna work well. So good. And so here they are. So these are the operators, and that's the when they were discovered, these mixing channels here. And the most severe constraints come from K0 and D0. They're on the level of 10 to the 3 TV. So flavor has a very high reach. Yes. And it should also be said that these constraints are even more severe in the lepton sector, as we have understood actually from the first talk of the conference. So this means that the new flavor structure, the new flavor better has a structure, otherwise we'll not be able to see it at the LHC directly, for example. And it's, if there is structure, it's also more likely to explain the old structure, because clearly the flavor is not completely anarchic. Yeah, good. Right, okay, so let's look at the symmetry, trying to clarify the flavor universality. If we put the Yukawa coupling to zero, then the standard model has an enhanced symmetry. A flavor symmetry in the quark sector is U3 to the fifth. U3 for the left-handed ones, for the right-handed up, and for the right-handed down. Now when you switch on the Yukawas, then this breaks down to the U1 baryon here. Good. Now, this is not an exact symmetry. Well, exactly because the Yukawas are switched on, then masses are generated. And so the fermion masses break this lepton universality, or lepton and quark universality, but not in the weak sector. So in the gauge sector, it's unbroken. Good. And in addition, if the matrices are misaligned, which diagonalize the mass basis, then we have flavor violation. So that's the CKM or PM&S matrix here. And this leads to having constant problems figuring out the buttons. Anyway, so this leads to charged flavor transitions at the tree level and to neutral flavor transitions at the loop level. So the first important message is that flavor universality is not a symmetry of the standard model, but crucially, it's controlled in terms of small quark masses or lepton masses. We expect to be able to predict quantities precisely. Okay, good. Now, sort of the dynamics. I think I can refer to Thomas's talk, taking advantage of energy scales. We have here the W scale, where we integrate out the W and the Z boson, and then we run down the effective Hamiltonian down to the B scale, and here we evaluate the matrix elements. Okay, and in terms of the amplitudes, this is the way it looks. We have here a B going via the effective Hamiltonian into some final state. And this is described by this OPE. Here are the Wilson coefficients, and they're supposed to be calculable in perturbation theory, and they carry potentially information from new physics from the high scale. And then we have the matrix element. That's really my specialty. Sort of how to estimate those matrix elements. They contain the infinite physics and they are non-perturbative here. And so the decays, they're classified according to the final state, x, y, z. Okay, so let's have a short look. These are the delta f equal 1 topologies. We have leptonic decays. There's not much to be said. There is here a quark bilinear and here a lepton bilinear. And when you evaluate it, all there is a decay constant. And you can, this decay constant is non-perturbative, and there are methods to evaluate it. We'll not talk about leptonic decays in this talk at all. Then we'll talk a bit about semi-leptonics. So here we have one hadron in the final state. So basically the classification is by how many hadrons there are in the final state. Here there are zero, and here there's one. And this is described by a single form factor. And again, they can be evaluated by non-perturbative methods. And it's sort of self-understood that the level of difficulty increases when you go down in the number of, or up actually, in the number of final state hadrons. Good. Then the radiative decays are Usually also with one hadron in the final state, but they're slightly more more difficult because they also, besides so-called short distance, so this is a short distance. Oh, now I take the hockey stick. This is a short distance contribution, but besides short distance contribution, radiative decays typically also have long distance contributions, resonances. And then questions like, oh, the Y went down. Questions like duality of quarks and hadron come into the game, and sometimes you have to resort to Wright-Wigner parameterizations of the resonances. And then the most complex decay that is studied are the non-leptonic ones with two hadrons in the final state. That's a very complex problem. Analytical approaches exist in the heavy quark limit, where factorization can be established, or at least shown to be consistent. An issue here is are the final state interaction, and of course then the corrections beyond the heavy quark limit. But in this talk, we will uniquely focus on this class here, because that's where the anomalies sit, so to say. Good. Right. Now, the next step is to look at angular distribution. So as I said, in this talk, we'll look at B to one final state hadron and maybe two leptons. And this one decays without interacting with the leptons, then maybe into two scalars. And this leads to a very nice angular distribution, which is useful. So here you can imagine your B, and this decays into a vector meson, which then in this case maybe it's a K star, and then goes into a K pi. So this gives you one angle, and then here a photon goes away and goes into the lepton pair. This gives you another angle, and then you have the helicity angle between the two decay planes. And you have two partial waves. You have the partial wave of the K star and the partial wave of the leptons. It's quite useful. Good. And so what is actually done? So you can write down, well, in a model-independent way, to some degree, an effective Hamiltonian at dimension 6. And you will find that there are 10 operators in total here. And they're classified in terms of the quantum numbers here of the lepton pair. So you can have here, this is scalar, pseudoscalar, and this is vector, axial vector, and this is tensor. And in the standard model, the light quarks are typically left-handed, but you can also write down light quarks which are right-handed, and this gives doubles the basis, but they're suppressed in the standard model because it's SU2L, not SU2R. Right, good. And then you can write down, you can compute this angular distribution here. And in the standard, so in this basis here, there is a total of 12 terms. And I've been, in this context, first computed by these people. And I think we sort of clarified why there are exactly 12 terms. And I can tell you sort of why. Here, the maximum wave that you're going to get, partial wave, since you have vectors here, is a P wave. And you can also get, of course, an S wave from the scalars. And then when you square that, the maximum spherical harmonic you're going to get is of L equals 2. And that's it. Good. And for example, you could get get higher spherical harmonics if you go to higher dimensional operators, but then you would need to introduce derivatives, and they would be of dimension 8. So that must sound very familiar to Thomas in terms of effective field theory. Good, okay. And so what we're actually doing in flavor physics is the observables, maybe I actually have this on the next slide. Let me, the connection to the dynamics. Good. So this is the full decay rate, the differential decay rate. We've got the three angles, and we've got Q squared. So Q squared, you need to remember, Q squared is the four momentum of the lepton pair. And then you can write down these 12 terms and, well, in a slightly cryptic way here, these are just spherical harmonics here.
And now, nine.
Sorry?
Nine.
Oh, I think this is to do with complex. Some of them are complex, yes, good point. Should have mentioned that. So how do they actually relate to the amplitudes? They relate to the amplitudes in the following way. These are then helicity amplitudes. Or maybe we first have a look. This is a B going to a K star, and the K star is helicity. And then V and A denote here the quantum number of the fermion bilinear. And then depending on, you see, depending on the spherical harmonic or on the partial wave, this thing connects to very specific quantum numbers of helicity amplitudes. And that's the connection there is between the two. So, yes, so what are we doing in flavor physics? So we want to get access to the microscopic theory. And our tool is this decay distribution, which is experimentally observable. So we can do an angular analysis or moments and extract these g functions here. And then we have access to very specific quantum numbers. And then there's a second tool we have. We also have the Q squared dependence, which is more to do with the dynamics here. And this helps us to disentangle short from long distance physics. That's really what we can do. Good. I hope that's clear. Right. Good. Okay, so this first part is now finished. And we can talk about the tensions, tree-level tensions. The main point about tree-level is that there are no sizable long-distance contaminations. So we expect this to be clean, theoretically. That's why it's a bit surprising. Okay, so CKM elements, we can either do them exclusive. So like here, B to pi, this will have a VUB here. And we have B to pi, or we can do B to rho, or we can lambda B to lambda. And they depend on form factor, that's the non-perturbative input here. Vector form factors and the scalar form factors are suppressed by the lepton mass. Again, this you can understand from the transformation properties of the amplitudes. It's actually fairly nice. And then this is my poor picture of the inclusive tool. So that's basically using the usual optical theorem together with the OP. So you have the matrix element squared is equal to the imaginary part of the closed loop, essentially, here. And the inputs for the inclusive case are universal matrix elements for the OP, which you can compute or extract from moments, and also the shape function, which to some degree is model dependent and can be fitted. There are efforts in doing that. And maybe some parts can be computed. I think Thomas and Gil are much more expert than I am on this. Good. Right. OK, so let's look at this nice overview by Gambino and Higgs-Maxwell. So here we've got VCB and VUB. Let me first say that for the last 5, 7, 10 years that I went to a conference, every flavor conference discusses tensions between VUB and VCB. Now they seem to disappear. That's good. OK, so here we've got VCB, and you've got the inclusive value, which people think is very solid. And here we have a few exclusive ones, now newer ones. Well, something happened this year, which is very useful. Bell released angular data. And so people in B2D star, so people were able to revisit some assumptions, some parameterizations. And there you go. The assumptions were too strong, taken by the experimentalists. VCB and D star has now shifted to here. So it's basically.
Is it shown in this plot, or?
Sorry?
So where is it shown?
It's not shown.
It's not shown.
No, Gambino didn't yet do it. That was actually, this happened just a month afterwards, or something like that. Yeah, this paper came out in March, and this conference was in February.
So this the paper, this is an analysis of Gambino of the Bell data. understand who's behind the reanalysis.
Yes.
And yes. The extraction from the lattice did not change, or the values of the what the lattice does did not change.
Next slide. Okay. I'll go. That's a good question. Yeah, I think I can do it on the next slide. Yes, it's easy to convey. Took me some time to figure everything out, but that's another story. Okay, so view B discussed even more heavily, even new physics models for view B. So here we've got so what's the story? We've got a range of exclusive decays, so B to pi. And lambda b and so on, and they're compatible with the unitarity triangle fit here. And the view b inclusive here used to be always quite far away. Now, Babar has done a reanalysis sort of a few months ago, and view b inclusive has moved down here.
And, so this is a one measurement.
Yeah, using the same, saying this is sort of Gambino, and the last one is Uralce for this. That's the method.
No, I'm not looking at the method. I'm just saying that it's a little bit dangerous when you take just one measurement, the one-way analysis, as opposed to taking averages.
It's not completely over, the story, but it's a first indication that this is also easing, actually.
You will explain what happened on the next slide, so whether we should disregard the upper band.
I can explain this one, not this one. So this Gambino's comments is that this needs checks. Maybe this goes into your direction and what you said. And there is actually another view B mode which hasn't made it on the slide yet. This should not be rho star. This is just rho L nu. So we get from B to rho L nu, we get a value which is around here. So, which is also compatible with the fit. So the short message for view B is that all exclusive modes are consistent with each other. They're consistent with the unitarity fit, and the old results of view B inclusive were quite far away. And now we have one which has moved down. So it looks like it's easing off.
No. Is on the next floor.
Oh.
Then there's quite some tension.
Yeah, it's probably a typo there. Yes. I did it in those units. That was not good. Okay. Yes, indeed, it's a typo. Yes, it's okay. Actually, our goal was to test our form factors. I basically kind of assumed that this is okay. I wanted to see whether our form factors are good. Good. Yeah, so the VUB tensions are disappearing in favor of global fits, but it's not fully sorted yet. But it looks like this will ease off. Good. Now I'm a bit confused because it should be.
You promised that you will explain.
No, actually, there should be a slide. Yeah, I think it will be, you have to wait another slide. Okay, but yet it's sort of instructive to quickly contemplate on right-handed currents. So this kind of became a game. You can, and this is very easy to understand. Now, instead of just putting a left-handed transition, you put the right-hand transition, you put a factor epsilon, and then you look what happens. And they go in different directions. The d goes down, and the d star goes up, and this goes quadratic. And unfortunately, or fortunately, this doesn't work, because d and d star go in the wrong direction. So immediately, right-handed currents cannot be behind the VCB tension. Good. For VUB, the situation was more interesting. At some point, there was the possibility that there could be right-handed currents. This was pushed forward by Kivelin. But when they did a generic analysis, of dimension 6 operators, then they found that there are actually tensions with Z going to BB. And then also the result from LHCb, which came in 2015 on lambda b to proton, kind of is not supporting right-handed currents. Good.
This second statement falls with Z to BB. So what does it mean? There's basically a conflict between the B physics data and the Z data?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah, they went to, I mean, his first push was actually in 2009. So then they took some time to look closer into this. So 5 years, it seems a long time to contemplate. OK, good. Yes, here, flavor universality. The tau versus the light leptons. So we've got this ratio here. And we've got, this is now a plot of, you can either do it this for d star or d. D star is the vector, d is a pseudoscalar. And this little thing here is the theory error. And here's the experimental average. And you have various results. It's Babar, which is off the furthest. But it's still remarkable that kind of, well, all experiments go in one direction. So it's, of course, also consistent with having a significant tension. So in principle, this is at the level of 3.9 sigma here. Good. Now I come to the point. So what goes into the theoretical prediction? Now, for B to D, there's no problem. There are good lattice results. But for B to D star, it's less clear. So there is a work that goes back 20 years, which assumes this expansion here. And they computed this coefficient at leading order in the heavy quark theory. And experimentalists have basically taken these coefficients here for granted. And then they have, for example, assumed the parameterization. And then I have extracted this factor here from the data directly. Right. And that's where this small error here comes from. And now, Bell has released new data, and it allowed people to revisit the story. Now, crucially also, initially, Bell just looked at electron muon mode here, and this allows to get the vector form factors, because remember, the scalar form factor is suppressed by the lepton mass, so you'll basically not see the scalar form factor. But for the tau here, the scalar form factor is going to be present, so the scalar form factor is basically unconstrained. Right, okay. The right thing to do is to make an angular analysis of B to D star tau mu. This has actually been mentioned at the last LHCb workshop. A time frame has not been given. But it's obviously the thing to do, because then we can cross-check here.
How much of the error was
going to shrink? Because you already have... Which ones? The theory?
The LHCb.
Ah, so that's on the next slide, sort of. Yeah, I've got the. It's always on the next slide. Yeah, okay. So.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, sure, sure.
The scalar form factor that you would need to explain it, is it reasonable in terms of what you could get?
I mean, the short answer is the theory cannot move here. But let's go to the next slide.
Okay.
We need to. Yes,
so, Arantxa.
VUB.
How do they analyze experimentally? Do they reconstruct the excluded modes? Or is there some. Do they rely on.
No, but which mode? VUB.
Sorry, your previous slides. Yeah,
yes?
Exclusive or inclusive?
Exclusive. Do they reconstruct the excluded case? Or do they use some perturbative input for B to left on the tree?
No, I just measure the rate, and then the rate is proportional to the CKM times the form factor. Then you depend on the form factor.
When they reconstruct, so what do you experimentally, when they analyze, do you know if they look at the exclusive modes or not at all? Do they use any perturbative?
They look at b to pi.
B to pi, okay.
B to pi, b to rho, lambda b to, and so on. Or also b to omega. Some of those are of variable quality. Most effort is put into b to pi. Now, okay, since you opened the parentheses, it's this summer, LHCb is going to come with b sub s to k bar. And this is also a view b mode. So that will be a further exclusive mode on that plot. But I mean, this is already done by Babar. This was a game that was played more than 10 years ago, principle. OK, so good. Right. Now.
Sorry, your complaint is that the scalar form factors are not constrained by experimental measures.
Yes.
But there is lattice calculations.
The lattice is surprisingly slow, but it's coming, of course, now. Well, I mean, the lattice always needs a few years, obviously, to. Sorry?
Didn't you have a reference in the previous slide?
HB. Yeah, but there's much more coming. It's actually a bit mysterious to me that the lattice has only produced one single form factor out of the four. And it's not clear to me why they haven't just put all the four, I guess.
Wasn't the Fermilab people had this long paper with all this other stuff?
It's coming. That's what I understood. I know also that the Oliver Witzel and friends are also computing. He said it's a mystery to him as well why they haven't put more form factors out. There will also be slope data. So all there is, as far as I understand, there are form factors at the kinematic endpoint. There's no slope information yet, but people are working on it. Good. Yes. Yeah, let's come now to the theory prediction. When this Bell data came out, this angular analysis is now being refined. This is actually work in progress. Here I've put the junior people in terms of reference. And this was reported at the LHCb workshop. OK. So the old error, which basically assumed no, took the Caprini, Lelouch, Neubert parametrization phase value, gets this value here for RD star with 1% error. Now, these guys have done a more refined analysis, now using the Bell data, and have included an error estimate for higher order corrections. And you see the value shifts slightly, and the error increases to a more realistic value here. But it doesn't jump to where the central experimental value, no way. So this.
Using the Neubert expansion parameterization, or what is different? What do they do differently?
Well, they can directly fit it. No, the wonderful C expansion. or a variation of it, which is known Boyd Grinstein Lebet, I think. Or you can now also extract extract the coefficients. Now, Neubert and friends predicted the coefficients, and they're fairly good, but it's 20 years old. But now you can go and check, because you've got the differential distribution and so on. So this is actually work in progress. And there's I think especially this group and Robertson Ligeti, they're coming with a lot of tools and things, because this is obviously a hot topic. Good. OK. Now comes the however. However, the tau is maybe a difficult particle. OK. So the inclusive rate here works quite well. There's a prediction by the theorist, which is very, very compatible with experiments here. And now compare this to the sum of the two exclusive modes here, experimentally, first of all. It's fairly high. But within errors, probably OK. But it sort of leaves you with an uneasy feeling about the whole situation. I think this is the, if you want to find my opinion, the slightly problematic point in all of this, that seems to be it. Looks like the two experiment modes already saturate the inclusive rate.
How much? Channels where more modes are measured
The rest, I'm not sure on the top of my head. It's actually Thomas Mannel and friends who are looking into this. But yeah, I think it's debatable. Not very much, of course. There's not much phase space.
There's something similar happens for non-tau, right? So in other cases, you add the D and a D star, and you get like what is it, back in the day, 70% or something.
Well, which for if this is a muon.
Instead of tau, you put electron.
Yeah, but then you also have more phase space. But okay, sure.
So maybe you're saying here there's even less phase space.
There's less phase space, yes. Maybe that makes it more credible, of course. But still, it sort of looks a bit strange. Okay, now the perspective. The good thing is that Bell 2 at 15 inverse Amtobarn is competitive with a theory error. And LHCb predicts an error on RD star of 4% at the end of run 2, which is quite good. So we'll know something in the foreseeable future. Or there's another good part. Also, the expansion can be improved, the Cabrini-Lelouch-Neubert expansion, and tested further with data. And I guess the other good part, actually, which I forgot, is that many lattice results will follow. Because this anomaly is sort of, I don't know, a few years old. And then the lattice always takes a few years to produce results, so results will come. Several groups are working on it. Good. Yeah, experimental prospects to settle it, and the theory improvement is also possible. So just one needs to remain patient. Good. Right. Okay. Flavor change neutral current tensions. First, a quick primer on theory. Then I'll summarize experiment results, fits, and the theoretical reappraisal of charm. Now, how am I doing for time? I don't think so great. Guys, it started quite late. Sorry?
15 past 11.
Half? Wait, how? Yeah, okay. So I might have to sort of be quite brief on some parts, but that's fine.
Remember, this is your
35
minutes.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't practice. So, B2K star LL under the microscope. So the standard model Wilson coefficients, first lesson is scalar, pseudoscalar tensor are approximately zero. Lepton mass suppressed. What I call CV is now in the literature called C9. Just keep that in mind, or actually, I can put it this way. So CV, the vector quantum numbers is C9, and the C axial is the C10. Okay, that's the way it works. Good mention. And then there are short distance contributions. So that's the 09 and 010. Maybe I should have actually put them down. So this, they're just left. Gamma mu, S, L bar, gamma mu, and gamma 5 or not. So that's how they look. So they're just a form factor here. And then there are these four quark operators where you have a B and an S, and maybe also a charm. And then this charm loop can close, and then a photon radiates off into leptons. And when this lepton pair reaches the energy of the charmonium resonances, there's no way you can avoid them. It will be visible. Good. Right, and so this is sort of a spectral plot. This is now the Q squared, the lepton pair. This is for B2 KLL. That's how it roughly looks. Down here, the kaon is very fast in the B frame, and all kind of light cone methods apply, some rules and QCDs get, and so on. And here, I sort of give you an impression which Wilson coefficients or operators actually dominate. And here you see the charmonium resonances, they're very, very high, and traditionally they were just cut out. Quite an interesting region here is this so-called high Q squared region at low recoil, where things become slow. You also have a few resonances. They are broad. Why are they broad? Because they can decay into D bar D. So this channel opens up, they become broad. It's very easy. And there's significant here, this is quite interesting. Here there's significant interference between the germanium and the short distance contribution, and that's crucial. And this shape here is very diagnostic, because remember, one of the tools we have is this Q squared dependence to figure out whether it's long distance or short distance here. What people have advocated is a so-called high Q squared OP. I will be more precise later on. Good. So the short distance is described by form factors. I don't want to spend any time on it, really. There are so-called tensors and vector form factors, and there are seven of them, and there are algebraic relations between them, too. And at low Q squared, when the light cone methods apply, there are light cone summable contributions, and you can either do it with a K-star or a B-meson distribution amplitude. And at high Q squared, that's the home of the lattice, there's this group has produced predictions. And here, yes, this is for Gill. They can be connected by the Z expansion. So it's consistent.
What are we seeing here?
This is sort of our data, actually, that we generate using Monte Carlo. And this is the lattice data. And then we can fit, and they're consistent. So it's yet another indication that these calculations are probably not too bad. Okay, good. Connects smoothly between the two. So this is one form factor. Okay, right. A brief overview of long distance contributions. There are two methods. You can work in QCD factorization / SCET, or with light cone sum rolls. The main difference is that here we've got a 1 over MB expansion, so you need to worry about 1 over MB terms, whereas this does not rely on 1 over MB expansion, but has some degree of model dependence, if you wish, but it can be reasonably controlled. And then there are different players in the game, and the ones which I will focus on is the so-called, later on, weak annihilation, where the B meson, if you wish, annihilates into maybe a W and then emerges as a V, and somewhere on the way it emits a photon and it goes to a lepton pair. And the other one, which is crucial, is the quark loop one, which I've already mentioned before, where the quark loop here can be a charm. Yeah. Okay. So I think here I will be brief and go to the next one. Experimental results. Good, this flavor universality, which was first advocated by Hiller-Kruger. You take the ratio of a B going to some hadron, mu over electron. And this we know to predict to a very, very high precision. This is basically for B decays as to B1, almost, okay. And this is the result from 2014, which has shocked some of us. There was sort of in this bin, 1 to 6, there was a 2.6 sigma deviation from the standard model. There are actually reasons to be slightly excited about this, despite that it's only a 2.6 sigma. So I'm defending my community. There are also reasons to be worried, because it's a very difficult measurement for LHCb. Good. But so we all thought, OK, so let's wait and see what happens. And then came the next shock a few weeks ago. They did it in the mode. So this is B to K, and this is B to K star. And they gave us two bins here. And again, so these are the theory predictions. They almost here lie on one. There's no difference between the muon and the electrons at high Q squared. At low Q squared, they shift a little bit down because of phase space effects. But nevertheless, here, the experimental result is a fair bit down here and here as well, and actually in the same direction. And you can all put it into a consistent picture. Now, the thing that really struck me and many others and everybody essentially, this cannot be the case. This is almost impossible. Because down here, at Q squared towards zero, this is dominated by the photon. It's dominated by the photon pole. It goes like 1 over Q squared, so it will always grow. The photon, we know, couples universally to electrons and muons. But there's no way this can be different. So Some people now have begun to speculate that this could be a new light resonance connected to dark matter. I don't know what.
How does this resonance couple?
Oh, that's
the property,
Maxim?
This has
the couple to be.
To be a BS?
Yes,
yes. Must be flavor changing.
It's not supported by the Q squared distribution, this idea.
That actually.
Much finer binning, right?
The this wasn't available when the papers came out instantly. They did not even have time to look at the more refined results by LECB.
Yes.
Good. Yeah. So most people think that this is a statistical fluctuation. But then, okay, if this is a statistical fluctuation, okay, the whole picture is interesting. So yeah, you can be excited or not about this, but I think
it's a one light resonance with narrow width. This stick like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
In LECB data.
Yeah, I think I actually do have a plot. Mm. Okay, so.
Yeah, you have 100 dark photons, right?
Yes. So, okay, theory cross-checks, then experimental cross-checks. So the first point is hadronic effects are universal, so they ought to cancel. Some caveats, maybe. What is non-universal is the phase space. I've mentioned that, but that's controlled. And of course, QED corrections, which are of a few percent. So in principle, these QED corrections, they could be alpha log squared mu over mu. Now, at the beginning, what we proposed is the following, and I have this on the next slide, is that we noticed that QED doesn't factorize, and QED has all moments. So QED hasn't got this cut at L equals 2 for the spherical harmonics. So if LHCb goes and measures the higher moments, they will get information on the QED corrections. But then, more crucially, Isidori and his group sat down this, a bit later, and they did the computation of the largest logs. And the summary is that in principle, the effect can be up to 10%, depending on the cuts. But Photos, which LACB uses, does an excellent job. And the corrections should be just around 1%. So, and the conclusion is that, therefore, RK and RK star is a good observable, a controlled observable. Good. OK. Let me quickly go into this QED business, but I think it's quite interesting. So here you would have usually B2K, your lepton pair, and here you would have a photon between the two. So what does it actually mean? Now it becomes a proper 1-to-3 process. All particles are connected with each other. They don't go just via this local vertex, which is either an S or a P wave. How can you see that? So it's a 1-to-3, so you can choose Mandelstam variables. And then S and U have this dependence on cosine theta L. And this dependence will enter the logarithms or polylogarithms, and they will expand to all orders in the spherical harmonics. So you will see those. So yes, then by measuring these moments, you can get information on QD corrections. Actually, this would also be a good thing to do even for a B2D star only. Measuring higher moments is a good thing. Good. Okay. Experimental cross-checks. Now for the K star, for the new modes, they have been quite careful and there are lots of checks now public. For K, they're not public and there's an update awaited from them. The first and most important check that everybody wants to see is the one at the JSI. So the JSI is long distance standard model. It cannot be lepton non-universal. Has to be one. And then you can take the ratio. So B now going to K star, JSI, and the JSI decays into mu mu or EE. This has to be one and it is consistent with one. It's also compatible with the second narrow resonance. So this time, for K star, there are no reasons to doubt experimentally. And then this is what Maxim has been referring to. This is some of the data they have released. not in the initial days, but a few days later. You have the data of mu mu in blue and the data of EE in orange here. Okay, and there's.
You say that there was artificially scaled to one, right? So it's R who disagree, right? So this is a distribution. Sure.
Yeah, that's it. Yes. Okay, it's Q. This is the actually this is the lowest spin. This is the highest spin.
Right, normalized such that everything, the integral under the curve is 1, right, or something like that.
But yeah, we're only interested in the shape, really.
Life,
yeah, we don't care about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Thank you clarifying this. So yeah, this is the first bin, and this is the second bin. So we don't see a dark photon or whatever, a flavored photon sticking out. Good. Sorry? Another one which is less exciting for the moment, but let's see. If you actually take the ratio of these branching fractions, we first noted this back in 2013, that this ratio here experimentally is on the wrong side of 1. And this year, if we want, we can improve this a lot. This was just an appendix that we put in the last minute. So it's something to be looked out for. And you can also ask the question, so this is for beta k star gamma. How does it look for beta k star mu mu? And if you look at differential distribution, again, it sort of persists. Here we have reasonable agreement. And in the B-sub-S to phi mu mu, it's a bit off. So this is the first sign of something. How can they actually differ, these two decays? So these two decays are basically the same. All you do is you exchange the spectator. You exchange the spectator, a light quark, with the strange quark. Small lifetime effect, not to worry. And then they have different form factors. Now, the form factors are normalized according to the input that goes in are the experimental decay constants. So I took quite some time looking into this carefully. You extract them from experiments. And okay, so we have certain errors, and we think we can trust them. Good. And then there is a third reason, and this is the most interesting one. They differ in weak annihilation. In weak annihilation, the basic message is the spectator is not a spectator anymore, but it becomes part of the flavor transition. So you have here have a B, and let's do it for the S, a B and an S, and here an S, and this would also be an S. And so this, if you have an operator B, S, S, S bar, then this only contributes to B sub S to phi, but not to B to K star. So such operators, in principle, could be at the origin of explaining this discrepancy if it persists. And you know, the story is there are actually very little constraints elsewhere. So we don't know. The constraints are from mixing and from non-leptonic decays. Good. Yes, angular observables. So this is how it all began, the whole hype here in 2013 at the EPS conference. NACB showed this plot. This is a standard model prediction, which maybe has to be revised a little bit. So this was at the time a 3.9 sigma, I forgot, something like that. And in 2017, it already looks a bit different. So look here. First of all, the error bar has increased here. And I think I'm partly responsible for that. Then there are more experimental results now. There is Bell came into the game, and also Atlas and CMS. Well, you see here the black ones, it's LHCb, which is the most precise results. And I think this is now sort of got a pull of 2.5 sigmas or something like that.
Sometimes it's very confusing, right? Because LHCb for that measurement looks on that mu plus mu minus, and Bell does both U plus mu minus and mu plus mu minus.
So Lepton universality comes into the game. Yeah, I suppose that's correct. Okay, so.
Yeah, there are also Atlas and CMS.
Good. Just before we do the global fits, maybe a short word about B sub S to mu mu. The only message I want to convey is that, well, it's an amazing measurement, and it's very close to the standard model. This is directly proportional to this axial form factor, and it's, of course, a very clean constraint on it, and it's very important. Okay, on this one here. But if you become excited about lepton universality, then it has to be said there is no constraint on C10e. Because this decay here is helicity suppressed. That's a crucial point. Good, so let's go into the global fits. Let's assume it's new physics. We'll discuss the standard model later. There are various groups doing fits, and here I've got an example. The real part of C10, the axial, and the real part of C9, and the standard model is at zero, so this is purely new physics. And this is the best fit up here. And, well, you see, some C10 is needed, but not very much. And quite a bit of C9 is needed. But the point is also that this is that's the same quantum number as QCD. So one has to be aware of that. Okay. So, in summary, there are no stringent signs of right-handed currents. There are no stringent signs of new physics in B to SEE, although it's also not excluded. And also, as I emphasized already, the non-QCD coupling, well, it's also not so needed, maybe. Often in models, C9 minus C10 is considered. If they would be courageous, then they would claim it's more than, it's, in a way, it's more than five sigmas, but people are not saying it too loud because of the hadronics. Yeah. Okay, good. Yes. Now on the importance of the charm contribution. So what could this large deviation in C9 actually be? That's just a reminder from before. We have this light cone region, and here we've got this high Q squared region where we've got the interference. At low Q squared here, really below the charmonium threshold, we expect the protonic methods to work. At high Q squared, people have proposed the so-called high Q squared OPE. The idea is that you use short distance. All the long distance stuff is parametrically suppressed. I think that's convincing, this part, except the charm, because obviously we see it here. So what they have assumed is that the charm is moderate, that it is described more or less by naive factorization. Then if you do this, this gives you an error of about 2% when averaged over this entire region here. You can average here. And then some of the bumpiness cancels, but not all of it. I've got a remark on the next slide. Good. OK. So now we can ask a question. Does naive factorization describe B2KL data? The answer is not really. You can take, so naive factorization is just, here we've got beta k, the C closes like this, and we assume that there are no gluons between the charm loop and the BS type thing. Then this is nothing but the vacuum polarization, and we can extract it from the best data. We can extract the imaginary part of the vacuum polarization, and then via dispersion relation, we can get the real part. This is from first principles, and I think most people here understand, and this is absolutely no problem. Okay, and then we can take this prediction and put it into the decay prediction. This here is B to K mu mu. In the high Q squared region here, for energies, because then you can see the masses, I guess. And so this is the experimental data here. And the blue curve is naive factorization, so what you take from E plus E minus here. And you see that it's not described by it at all. In fact, it's whenever there is a peak, the data shows a dip. So actually, the interference is just the opposite sign of naive factorization. The chi-squareds are really good. There is no reason to doubt the fits. Good. Okay.
How's the comparison on the light plot? I mean,
how do I?
It's not bad.
How do
I? Now it's taken all together.
Sorry?
Ah,
if you average.
Yeah.
Well, you can do the exercise and then it goes sort of to, well, I could, there are various comments to be made. It's at least 10% rather than 2. And then there are there's actually more trouble. No, I can.
Significant are those deviations, right? I mean, if you have like 30 bins, you expect some of them not to fit perfectly.
No, but this is a complete mess.
Yeah, this is horrible.
This is all wrong.
It looks like it's shifted. By
eye, yeah, it's shifted. No, but give me.
What's the chi square of it, for instance?
Of this one, about infinity, but I can show you. I can show you a good fit. Okay, so this fit here, the best data is as good as it can get.
Sure.
And this is horribly wrong. But now let me tell you how to make it right.
Okay.
Okay. Good. So can we understand the data? The answer is yes. Okay, and that's it. So the way to understand this is as follows, sort of by first principles. If you're close, if your Q squared is close to the resonance, this will have sort of a bright Wigner form here. Okay, where this is the amplitude for B going to the germanium times K, and then the germanium decays into the L plus L minus here. And so what naive factorization does is that it replaces this amplitude by naive factorization here. But then we can actually we can let this be a fit parameter because naive factorization is broken by some complex number. So the ratio of the naive factorization amplitude over the real amplitude is just a complex number. And this complex number we can fit because the shape is so diagnostic. And that's what we've done. So here you see the same data and you see various kinds of fits. And actually, yes, so the orange curve is the one which assumes naive factorization, and the red one here, the red dotted one, is the one which basically just takes eta, let's say a factor, naive factorization, and multiplies it by -255 eta naive factorization. If you do this, you get the red dotted curve. And you get the chi squared, well, I forgot the exact number, maybe it's 1.4 or something like that. But there's no reason for this actually to be uniform over the entire region. We also did fits here where we let it float, where we let the residue, rho r is the residue, we just let it be a complex number. And then the chi squared is very good. And you can actually understand this data. And the message is just that naive factorization is badly broken. Good. Yes. Now we come maybe a bit more to the implications and the question of your binning. So yes, factorization is badly broken, and duality violation is at least sort of 10% in the 10% range, and not just the 2% range. Now let's come to a very crucial statement, which is not always appreciated. There is no duality in exclusive processes for branching fractions. And the reason is that branching fractions are not related to endpoint functions. It's only the case for inclusive decays. In order to give reliable predictions, in my opinion, one needs to reconcile the hadronic picture at high Q squared with the protonic picture at low Q squared. If we can do that convincingly, then we can trust predictions. Even here, again, and that's there was quite some undertone in our paper, we also raised the question whether the BSCC, whether there are more BSCC operators than we think of. It was initially not met with lots of enthusiasm, but now people have actually begun to investigate this more seriously by writing down an effective theory at the high scale and running it down. Alexander Lenz and Sebastian Jaeger and collaborators. Good. What is missing to do a good job? Okay, the really thing that is missing, we don't have the interference phases of the J-psi and this should be under psi 2s here. We don't know them. we didn't know them at that time. We just know the absolute value of it. We know the absolute value from the branching fraction measurements. But now LHCb has underdone an effort and has tried to measure those, but with limited success because they have a fourfold degeneracy here. That's crucial. Why is this so? Narrow resonances are much harder because there is not so much interference. A narrow resonance would just stick out like a needle and will not want to interfere a lot with your other amplitude. So if they're broad, it's much, much easier to get the interference. Yes, another thing which is missing, so this is at the hadronic side, this is at the protonic side, is a consistent and complete treatment of charm beyond the heavy quark limit. Now, why is the charm so important? It's sizable because it's a tree-level Wilson coefficient, 0.1. Second, the matrix element is the order alpha s, a matrix element is color-enhanced, NC-enhanced, so it will always be large. It's not a complete surprise that there are the non-factorizable contributions are large. In a way, this has been known for a long time. What hasn't been known, for example, is that this phase is even minus, which makes it even worse. Okay. And there are only partial results available. Yes, so how can you do it beyond the heavy quark limit? You can do it with Lycon sum rules, and then you can do it with either method. There are highlight here two contributions. So essentially here you have the charm loop, and then you need to make all the alpha s connections. Now this one here is more or less known. It's actually quite small. It's important for right-handed currents. It depends, though, on the normalization of this matrix, of these kind of matrix elements. And I would very much like to that lattice physicist actually would check this matrix element here. That would be important, and it's actually absolutely doable. Might be difficult to do the renormalization, but it's doable. Good. Okay, so this part is fine. Now, the part which is not fine is this diagram, where the gluon is here, the vertex corrections. The vertex corrections are known in the heavy quark limit by the Bern group, by Christoph Greub and collaborators, and they're actually large. So what happens in the heavy quark limit? Well, this factorizes into a loop times the short distance form factor. That's in a way pretty, but it's troublesome, because this means you inherit the polarization properties of the short distance. But if the long distance has different polarization properties, these angular observables can shift a lot. So this is it's not only that it's a correction, which is 1 over mb, which by itself can be large sometimes, but it also might go in a completely orthogonal direction, which might affect your results quite a bit. So that's the problem. Yes, radiative corrections, what's the problem? So if you want to evaluate this diagram here, what you need to evaluate are two loops, about five scales, and the integration over a distribution amplitude parameter. And in my opinion, you should do it exactly, because you actually want to check the dispersion relation. And that is, I've talked to quite a few professional loop calculators, that's way beyond what can be done currently. But maybe one can sit down and think of an approximate scheme to do it. Good, okay. Model building. Yeah, now I just go, how much time? I'll be very brief on that. Yeah, this is perfect. Okay, there's lots of activity. There are severe constraints on lepton flavor violation and universality from the first and the second generation. Now here, what model builders do, they single out a third generation. Is this reasonable or not? Not completely unreasonable, because the top is a very heavy particle and has been a problem for model building for many decades. And in so-called composite Higgs models, it's solved by treating the third generation in a very special way, by coupling it to a baryon of a hypercolor group, which then generates electroweak symmetry breaking and the top mass. So it's not completely irrelevant. Here, these are the wires. Goes down to Georgi, goes back to Georgi and Kaplan, and was revived in 2000s, and recently Ferretti has proposed an almost complete UV model. Almost. Because the more UV complete it gets, the more it can be put on the lattice. And there's now some activity within our group to push this. Good. And people have been speculating on the light resonance. I think we take that one off. One may, as usual, distinguish three levels. One can either just write down an effective theory and do RG running, be quite agnostic about it. One can introduce a specific mediator particle, or one can introduce a UV-complete model, anomaly-free, renormalizable, and so on. Okay, good. Yes, this is a slide that I took from Guadagnoli's. And you see some activity here. Maybe first I have to say most models have mediator couplings to leptons and quarks, and leptoquarks, Z primes, charged Higgs. And here are some of the mediators classified according to their quantum numbers of SU2L and SU3 color. The leptoquarks, okay, this is a leptoquark couples to a lepton and a quark here. It has to be in a color triplet representation, for example. And then you've got here Z primes. And they have various advantages and disadvantages, and one can discuss that in more detail. Good. So the story of one model, which or one sort of idea, which I find quite interesting. Now let's consider a third generation coupling before electroweak symmetry breaking. So we've got here B to tau, B prime B, and yes, tau. And so the prime denotes, this is before, this is in the electroweak eigenbasis, not in the mass eigenbasis. Here we put our C9 and C10 here. This should actually be a mu, of course. Good. Now, when you then go and diagonalize, you go to the diagonal basis, this will actually, in general, induce lepton flavor violation. So you'll pick up not only diagonal terms, but also off-diagonal terms here. And that's the way they go when you diagonalize. So you have B to K E mu over B to K mu mu, then becomes this ratio. Well, this is the delta C10 that you see above there. And these are the elements from the matrix that diagonalize into the mass basis. So there are bounds on B to K E mu, and these bounds introduce a relatively weak bound on this element at the moment here. But the point is that if you start from here, you cannot avoid this. And even, you know, you don't know what this is, but because this matrix is unitary, at some point it will be visible. And so this is now, people have really begun to look for these modes. So lots of new PhD students, postdocs are looking into these modes. So that's, I really like this approach because it's sort of a generic thought and then leads to a generic analysis. So that's quite good. And the story goes on. You can make it SU2L invariant. Then there is also a relation to charged transitions, which is sort of welcome because to some people, because you have the B to C L nu tension. And there's the, sort of a flip side to everything. You should also do RG running, and this has been pointed out by these people. And then you run into severe constraints from lepton flavor universality violation. Yes.
And what was the problem to investigate, say, for Bell 2 or Babar, this mode, B to K?
Oh, that I don't know. You think it could just...
I understand that at LHCD, you know...
I don't know whether it's... I don't know. Maybe it's manpower. I don't know. I mean, as we have seen, Bell and Babar are now revising lots of their B to C L new modes. So I could well imagine that. Good. Okay.
About the first point with the rotation in the mass space.
Yes.
If you're willing to be contrived, you can just define your operators in the mass space to begin with, right? And then you don't have that problem.
Yeah, that's an assumption of the model. Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
It's not a theorem.
It's not a theorem. Yes. Yeah, so some people actually, well, okay, then let's not say that it's recorded. Okay, so the Z prime model, which began with Gold and Uhaheish and so on, and then actually Maxim and collaborators came up with a nice story. You consider a U1 prime, which my understanding is that then is Higgs'd by some phi particle. And then there are maybe some heavy particles, and then you generate this coupling BS to Z prime, and then you also need to do the other end for the lepton pair. And so this is a gauged L mu minus L tau model. So that's the those are the charges of the Z prime. That's how it couples to the leptons. And this is attractive. This is an attractive combination for neutrino model building. So when I was in Southampton, Steve King had many talks on this. Good. So in their honor, their model predicted lepton flavor universality violation just before the anomaly came out. So this was recognized universally also by the experimentalist. Good. The second good point is that they immediately tried to constrain it more seriously. And apparently there is an old experiment called Trident, which constrains the Z prime severely. Also, my understanding is talking to Maxim because the standard model has destructive interference.
That's right.
Yes, well, that's a crucial point. Yes, and this is a famous plot of the coupling, I guess here G prime and this MZ mass, and you see here the various constraints. And if you want to know more details, please ask Maxim. Good. Okay. Right. Conclusions. Yes. So there are some interesting tensions. The good news is that we will know more. The CKM corner, VUB, this is actually, no, this is VCB inclusive is winning and VUB exclusive, this should be as a typo, should be winning. And it would be good if this clarifies completely. And this seems to be the case, and that's very good news. Because then we can, I think, makes me trust some of the other calculations and measurements more. Lepton flavor violation. Yeah, there's lots of excitement about this RK-RK star. Photon pole in the first spin. I mean, how can it be, like resonance? Future needs more data, of course, cross-checks, and also Bell 2, because Bell 2 will be just better at electrons. RD star, experimental point. Bell 2 and LACB have good perspectives, so they will be compatible sooner or later with the theory error. So that's what we want usually. We want them to be balanced. There is also an interplay between experiment and theory. The angular analysis helps to check form factor predictions and to extract them on the various assumptions. And the more information we have, the more the better it is. On the theory side, the lattice will provide more form factors. And also, not only at the kinematic endpoint, but also the slope. Good. Oh, I'm here. Angular anomalies. What we need is more Q squared bins also in fast recall. Remember how we got all this information on CHARM is but LHCb just gave us finely binned data. So actually, initially, they didn't know what to do with it. And so they gave it to the theorists, and we took it, and we did the fit. And now they're actually doing the fit themselves. OK, so we need to know the residues of these charmonium resonances. In particular, we need to know these strong phases. Because that has obviously, if you go from plus to minus, this is a huge impact on your prediction close by. And I think generally what we should be doing is we should work out observables which isolate Wilson coefficients with definite quantum numbers. And my impression is that not everything has been done here. For example, we should try to isolate this CE10, assuming now there could be lepton universality violations. We should try to isolate these kind of operators in observables. And here is sort of this, this is not yet actually a big thing, but I still want to mention it. LHCb has measured this time-dependent CP asymmetry, which is sensitive to right-handed currents. and the value, so this can only be between minus 1 and 1. It's very close to minus 1. The theory prediction is almost 0. It's a huge error. And again, it's sort of a big question mark what this could be. But actually, if you have too many of those, if you have more operators of this type than in the standard model, then this can shift. So again, it's an interesting point. And are there observables where the charm can be completely eliminated? I think there might be, but one has to look. And yes, my general impression is that not all possibilities have been exploited. Thank you very much for your attention. Okay,
thank
good.
Thank you very much for that. Nice and comprehensive.
Long.
Question I have is we don't have a LACD experimentalist here, but the question I have is that there is such a marked improvement between run one and now, run two, right? Because this year they released B sub S to Mu, which before they have to be friends with CMS and just see this thing. Now it's 8-10 sigma measurement just by one experiment. Is there similar kind of pace of the progress you think that will be in a semi-leptonic decay?
Semi-leptonic?
Well, in all this B to K, K star.
You mean radiative now or semi-leptonic? No, because initially I think
correct, sorry. In B to K, K star, L plus, L minus.
Yes.
If the progress is going to be similar to this advice to me, we're going to learn.
I'm actually, maybe I'm ignorant of what the true reason is for that vast improvement. But.
No,
it cannot be. No. There's not much more data, actually. It's not the data. I'm actually a bit, I'm a bit surprised. For the decay B sub S to mu mu gamma, we've done some estimates, and there was no. All we folded in was actually the femtobarons and maybe the larger cross section. So I'm not sure what the problem with this analysis was. I don't know. No, I can't answer. Yes.
So I think it's concerning what the previous slide, which you were writing. I guess you're relying on Paolo Gambino's slides, but you know, things need to be still be averaged and
You mean the first point?
Well, both points, I think. You just, it's a little bit dangerous if you just look at one specific analysis and one specific measurement. You know, you need to kind of do more.
Yes.
More larger average.
Sure.
In
a way, it's one of the strengths of flavor physics that we have so many modes, and we have many methods to usually tackle them, and they better agree.
No, I'm saying these are interesting new analyses, experimental analyses, pretty much, but one needs to also do these averaging before one, you're taking one measurement to one analysis, and you're saying,
I think the point was that we have never seen an inclusive analysis so low. Or at least, so that's what I'm taking from it.
Sorry, you're talking about the
VUB, yes, inclusive. VCB seems fine to me. VCB is now, I think it's really considered done. It wasn't a big tension anyway, but okay, VUB, yes, it's not completely settled. Did I put it here?
Head tension. I mean, if anything, I think some of the exclusive VCB actually moved up, but there is still tension in VCB. I mean, if you look at averaging, I'm underlying things like, again, you talk about one analysis, two new papers, which is very interesting.
Yes.
It's still too early to call these things, you know, resolved or.
They can reappear. But at the moment, it's just good that they're going in the direction of resolution. Okay. I cannot predict the future. Good. Good. Okay. Thank you.